Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about bears to begin the program today. You know, there are only 8 species of bears left in the world. And so we're going to be learning more about, well, maybe polar bears and grizzly bears, black bears, panda bears, and more with our guest, Gloria Dickey. She wrote 8 Bears, Mythic Past and Imperiled Future. And it is a dandy book. I really enjoyed it. She's a global climate and environment correspondent at Reuters News Agency based in London. She's written for the New York Times, The Guardian, National Geographic, and more. And she's won many awards for her work and reporting on the environment. So as we talk with her about her book, I hope you'll join in. Which bear is your favorite? Or maybe why saving a specific bear species is important to you? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Gloria Dickey, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having me today.
Well, maybe we should just start with the 8 bears. That's the title of your book, 8 Bears. And of course, there are 8 species of bears. And which ones are we talking about?
Yeah, it's funny. I think most people are surprised to learn there's only 8 bears, but then when you ask them to name them, they can only name 4 anyway. So most of our most familiar with the American black bear, which of course is, you know, pretty numerous in the U.S. You've got the brown bear, which the grizzly is a subspecies, the panda bear, which is actually a bear. Most people think it's not a bear for some reason. You have the polar bear up in the Arctic. And then some of the lesser known bears would be the moon bear and the sun bear, which live in Asia. The sloth bear, which was one of the world's deadliest bears, which lives in the Indian subcontinent. And last but not least, you have the spectacled bear, which lives in the Andes of South America.
That was interesting. You talk about your own experiences and maybe tell us what inspired you to write a book about bears.
Yeah, well, I'm actually calling in from Boulder, Colorado right now, and that was kind of where this book began nearly a decade ago, because I came here to do my master's in environmental journalism. And the year that I moved here, there were tons of conflicts between black bears and people over garbage in town. And Boulder was actually the first kind of city of its size in North America to introduce a bylaw requiring people to put their garbage in bear-resistant trash bins. So as a kind of budding journalist, I began reporting on that issue. I ended up doing more bear work. I looked at, you know, grizzly bears in Yellowstone, polar bears up near Churchill, Manitoba, and then that kind of just, I guess, snowballed into all of the world's bears. And I don't think that I knew there were 8 bears back then. I think I thought there were only like 4 or 5 as well. So,
well, did you keep track of your mileage? You should have a lot of frequent flights. I mean, you were in Vietnam, China, Peru, Canada, of course, and then, as you say, parts of the U.S.
Yeah, I basically lived out of a backpack for like nearly 3 years before the pandemic, just kind of following the bears or following scientists, following bears. I did try to like link things together. So I did like kind of all of Asia at once and then Ecuador and Peru and, you know, kind of the U.S. and Canada as it came. But it was a lot of time on the road for sure.
We always get plenty of calls when we talk about bears on the show, and everybody seems to have their own story about an encounter. Maybe you could talk about the human connection, humans' connections with bears.
Yeah. So, I mean, the goal of this book wasn't just to kind of do a, you know, a treatise on like the biology of bears, but rather to like look at human relationships with bears, because I found the same thing. Whenever you bring up bears, people kind of light up and they have their own little story or anecdote about an experience with a bear. And so, yeah, there's a pretty long history between humans and bears going all the way back to like Aristotle, Pliny the Elder. You know, they kind of draw comparisons between humans and bears. Lots of indigenous stories where the, you know, bears are shapeshifters that move between human and bear form. So, yeah, there's definitely a really strong connection. And we typically have always like kind of expanded and lived in similar places to bears as well. They're found on every continent except Africa. They used to be there, but we killed them. You know, Antarctica and Australia, because koalas are not bears. So yeah, there's definitely a really interwoven connection throughout history and myth between people and bears, which I think is really neat.
You know, Tony in Milwaukee has a comment or question. Let's go there because it relates to one of the bears that you were talk about in your book. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you? Hey, Larry.
Great, appreciate the call. What's you've done some research on polar bears?
Yep, up in Churchill, Manitoba, back in the early 90s, I was doing research on polar bears to see how PCBs were affecting polar bears in the western and eastern hemisphere and their migration patterns around Churchill and the Hudson Bay area, and seeing how the beginnings of global climate change back then were affecting the bears and how that was going to be reflective on how that was going to affect human beings over time.
Well, that's interesting. I'm glad you brought it up, Tony, because I happen to know that Gloria's favorite bear, she's admitted to it in her book, is the polar bear, although she loves all bears, I think. The polar bear is, and you spent some time in Churchill as well. Talk about polar bears a bit.
I did. It's interesting that you mentioned studying the PCBs in polar bears, because I know a lot of polar bear biologists got into studying polar bears to look at pollutants and ended up looking at global warming instead. So I went to Churchill, I think, on three different occasions. I've been to Svalbard to look at the population there as well. The polar bears of Western Hudson Bay have declined about, it had been 30% since the 1980s. The government actually just published new numbers in December, finding the population's declined even more just in the past, I think, 5-6 years. So there's only about 600 polar bears left, whereas before there were well over 1,000 migrating through that area back in the 1980s. And as I'm sure you know, like, polar bears are spending a lot more time on land now because their sea ice is disappearing. So they can't, you know, spend as much time out hunting on the ice. They're fasting on land for longer periods of time, and they're often getting into more trouble. We've seen quite a few attacks, not necessarily in Western Hudson Bay, but a bit north of there in Nunavut in the past few years, of these increasing conflicts between polar bears and people due to the melting sea ice.
Tony, thanks. And maybe talk some more. I mean, you mentioned you do get into the biology a bit of bears, and I found it interesting, the biology of a bit of polar bears.
Yeah, so polar bears actually evolved out of brown bears fairly recently in terms of, like, evolutionary history. I think, you know, a few hundred thousand years ago, there was a group of brown bears that kind of headed towards these Arctic seacoasts, and they slowly, you know, they turned white. They kind of reverse the traditional season of the bear. So, you know, they're eating when other bears are sleeping and vice versa. But they actually share a really close genetic connection to brown bears still. And what we're seeing with climate change is brown bears are moving further north. Polar bear populations will likely shrink. There'll be more intermixing between the two, and they can actually create fertile offspring. So they can create these hybrid bears that people call Pizzly bears or Growler bears. And then scientists expect that eventually the brown bear DNA will kind of swamp the polar bear DNA, and we'll only have brown bears in the Arctic, you know, in a few hundred years, perhaps. Or, I mean, evolution takes longer than that, but eventually you will see this kind of the grizzly being the new king of the north.
Yeah. And polar bears, they need to be out on the ice because they need to get to seals. And I guess they only eat the blubber of seals.
Yeah, they stake it over the seal breathing holes, waiting for the little seal to pop up, and then, you know, they kind of pounce. But seals are just, they're just so high in calories, right? So, I mean, people have asked, like, can polar bears eat something else? Can they eat geese or eggs? But, like, then the amount they would need to eat is just so great for a bear of that size that it probably can't sustain itself on different food sources, and they're not very good at hunting, you know, like caribou or things like that, which would make things easier.
And they need to survive. I mean, they build up their fat levels, and they need to go a long time without eating much.
Yeah, so in Western Hudson Bay, like, the bears kind of head out onto the sea ice around October, November, throughout the winter, you know, eating as much as they possibly can. Mm-hmm. And then when they arrive back on land around June, they're just fast. They're not eating anything really for, you know, months and months at a time. They're just burning through how much fat they were able to get. So that's why it's so important that polar bears spend as much time as they can on the ice feeding, because they need that fat to, like, make it through the summer, essentially, back on land in that area.
Yeah. And when they're back on land, I think you said they lose something like 2 pounds a day.
Yeah, they're dropping weight super fast, and by the time they head back out to the ice, they're kind of like, you know, they're quite a, it's like the Weight Watchers diet for polar bears. They're quite thin.
Oh, so polar bears. Let's talk about some of the other bears as well. Spectacle Bears is interesting. I like the heading for your chapter on that. Called them Cloud Dwellers, and Paddington Bear is a spectacle bear.
That was
a funny story relating to Michael Bond and the who created the Paddington Bear.
Yeah, he had written that Paddington came from deepest, darkest Africa, which I'm sure, you know, is kind of a familiar phrase back in the day. And his agent was like, well, there's no bears there. So he had to go and quickly find a backup location. And so he settled on deepest, darkest Peru instead. But I think, you know, most people don't even, Paddington doesn't look like a spectacle bear, right? He's kind of like an orangey, marmalade-ish color himself. Spectacle bears, you know, they're called that because they have kind of these white markings on their face that makes it look like they're wearing glasses. So, very different.
Very different. And how do they act, or what do they, you know, where do they reside and so forth? Talk about that.
Yeah, they're super shy. They're super, I guess, not aggressive compared to what we normally think about bears. They like to stay up in the kind of forest canopy in the cloud forest, which are these really special forests in South America that are essentially watered by clouds. You have a really thick cloud cover when you're, you know, hiking through, and it waters all of these really unique plants that live there. And so these bears will build little, like, the scientists call them nests. They kind of build these little nests, and they'll just sit there, and they'll eat, and they'll rest, and they'll stay out of sight. And so that's their primary habitat. But it's those cloud forests are disappearing with climate change. That's a concern for them.
Yeah, and their range has dwindled quite a bit over the years.
We haven't quite seen that yet. I mean, we've seen that in terms of like agricultural expansion and mining.
Yeah.
The concern is that the bears don't seem to want to use the lower elevations, like into the Amazon, even though there's a lot of food there. And scientists aren't really sure why that is, why they're not going further down. But that's concerning because the cloud forest is shrinking from the bottom. So they're hoping that they can try and use some different habitat in the future to hold on.
Gloria Dickey, our guest today, a global climate and environment correspondent. She's got a great new book out. It's titled Eight Bears, Mythic Past and Imperiled Future. And you can join in with your own questions or comments or experiences with bears. The number to call, I've had a few myself, I can tell, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Tyler Dinner, our engineer today, Clara Neipert's our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Gloria Dickey. Her book is Eight Bears, Mythic Past and Imperiled Future. Questions, comments, experiences, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Mitch and Mazamani emailed us. He says he's heard of cinnamon bears and wonders what is a cinnamon bear. I had a little experience with them not long ago.
A cinnamon bear. So people, you know, you hear American black bear, you think, okay, well, they're black. And black bears, and as well as brown bears, come in all different colors. You can have blonde grizzlies, you can have bluish gray grizzly bears. Cinnamon bears are typically a black bear that just has a cinnamon colored coat. So it's just the color of the bear, if I recall correctly. But there's often, you know, there's some funny newspaper corrections where you'll see a newspaper refer to a brown bear, and then they'll be like, correction, it was actually a brown black bear. So there's a lot of confusion around what colors. You know, there's even spirit bears up in Canada that are all white. These all white brown bears that people, you know, pay a whole bunch of money to go and try and see along the Great Bear Rainforest.
I was playing in a golf tournament in Saskatchewan in May, and in a provincial park, and the setting in Waskasu. And we were just coming off one of the greens, finished putting out, and a big old cinnamon bear came walking out of the forest and decided he wanted to be on the green, and we let him.
Did he win?
Yeah, you're 20 feet away from this cinnamon bear, and discretion, the better part of valor there. Yeah. And so away we went.
Yeah, I always tell people, don't look at the color, look for the hump, right? If you want to see if it's a grizzly bear or you want to see if it's a black bear, look for whether or not it has a little hump arching over its shoulders, because color does not tell you everything.
Cheryl in Bessemer, Michigan, will give you a chance. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I'm going to tell you my first encounter with a bear. Anyways, I used to be a little tomboy, and I must have been about 5 or 6. I was pretty young, and I went with the guys, and we went into this, there used to be a potato farmer or whatever, and we were picking strawberries, and the guys went home, and I'm sitting there in the strawberry patch, and just kind of dazing off, you know, and I look up, and there's a young bear on the other side of the patch eating strawberries too, and it scared the crap out of me.
I bet it did.
Do you know the story Blueberries for Sale? Have you heard of that book? There's a book that's like the exact same premise, where there's a little girl and a little cub are eating blueberries from the same patch.
Cheryl, thanks. That's a good story. And that had to be a black bear. I think she said that. And black bears, we are loaded with black bears in Wisconsin. Black bears are don't seem to be in much danger of becoming extinct anytime soon. And you tell some really fascinating stories about black bears. Lake Tahoe comes to mind to me. Just tell that little story.
Yeah, so you're right. Black bears are the world's most plentiful bear species. There's nearly 1 million of them between the U.S. and Canada. So in terms of, endangered, they're not endangered by any means. And they've actually made a really great recovery in the U.S. But what we are seeing is this kind of urban bear phenomenon, where bears are coming in to towns, you know, or maybe in the case of Lake Tahoe, I mean, it's built kind of in this wilderness area to begin with. And they're eating a lot of garbage, and it's getting warmer. And in some cases, the bears aren't hibernating as much as they used to. And that's concerning, because when bears are awake more, they have more time to kind of get into trouble, to get hit by cars, because they're not going to hibernate during the winter. And I think, you know, in Lake Tahoe, we've seen instances of like bears walking into gas stations and leaving with bags of chips. They've broken into bakeries to eat butter. So there's this really big, like, kind of food climate issue that's happening in California.
And Yosemite, I was really fascinated by the story of some of our national parks, Yosemite, one of them, where the bears became habituated to food, and to get them not to be habituated was quite a process.
Yeah, I'll give a quick shout out to Rachel Mazur, who wrote this phenomenal book called Speaking of Bears, about the history of Yosemite dealing with these very hungry black bears and a problem that they created. And she actually works for the National Park Service. But if you're really looking for a very lively historical account of what Yosemite's done, I would recommend checking out her book. And I sample some of it in mine as well. But Yosemite basically used the bears back in the early 20th century as like a tourism spectacle. So tourists would come in, they'd watch, there was a dump that was inside the park. The bears would come, they'd eat, they'd put bleachers up. People paid to watch the bears in some cases. People were often attacked by the bears, unsurprisingly, you know, this kind of food frenzy. And Yosemite had a real problem trying to deal with this issue. And even today they have, for example, they've got an impound yard in the park. So if you leave food in your car and a ranger sees it, your car's getting towed, you know, because of that, because it's so likely that the bears could break into it. But yeah, they've got a real kind of chaotic history with the American black bear in Yosemite.
And they had to eliminate all food source, I mean, all human food sources, which was a monumental
challenge. Yeah. I mean, they put all, if you go into the campsites, they have all the, you know, bear lockers that are kind of difficult for bears to figure out. But the bears do figure them out, and every few years they have to replace them, because the bears will learn and they'll teach it to the other bears. So they're constantly having to kind of retrofit, create new designs that will help prevent bears from getting into people's foods and the campsites.
Yeah, it's amazing. Nancy in Duluth, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling, Nancy.
Thank you for your great programs, Larry. And I love bears, because when I was a sophomore at a private college in St. Paul, 1974, my wonderful biology advisor said, called me in his office because we were approaching winter term, which is the 1 month of going somewhere. Smart people went down to Florida. I went to Ely, Minnesota to work with one of Lynn Rogers. He's the foremost, he's the bear guy of Minnesota. He started the research in the, you know, quite early. And my job was to go out with this guy who was his main field organizer. It was just the two of us. Every day we went out, it seemed to be 20 below. We would have to, after we reached the end of a trail, we would go to the dens of female bears that had been tracked, you know, with the primitive stuff we had back then. To their dens, and our job was to pull, to tranquilize and pull them out, and weigh them, you know, check them out, pull a tooth for how old they were, et cetera. My job, among other things, was to, at 20 below, safely get a needle into the femoral artery of the bear and take and fill 5 tubes with blood.
Wow.
And believe it or not, we got her done, and we did only 5 or 6 bears that went that just in that month. But eventually, people found out and wanted to go out with us to this, you know, amazing thing. And we never had any bad results. We got the females out, and because I was a smaller person, I had to help push them back in because this tall guy I was with was too big. So it was. It was probably the best winter of my life.
That's amazing. I'm jealous.
Oh, that's an amazing story. I want to go back to polar bears for a minute because you tell a great story about a polar bear researcher who darted a polar bear, and then it kind of got into the water. Explain that.
Yeah. Andrew DeRoche, he runs the polar bear lab up in Alberta, Canada, and he's got a really long history with polar bears. He's a great scientist, and he told me on his first time out, they gave him the dart gun. He goes up to Churchill, to Western Hudson Bay, and he darts the polar bears from helicopters often. So this was his first trip. He sees a female, he darts it, but instead of going down where she is, she wanders over to a shallow lake and kind of like collapses with her head underwater. So he has to jump down. They're waiting for reinforcements. I can't quite remember the exact details, but they have to try and heave this polar bear out of the lake so that she doesn't drown. And you know, he said years later he'd still see that bear, and you know, she kind of look at him like maybe she remembered that incident.
Well, he had to hold the bear's head up to keep it out of the water while the other guy ran for help.
Back to help. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And he's wondering, is the bear going to wake up while I'm holding on to its head? There are some great stories. You tell some great stories in your book. Nancy, again, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. You can join in, too, if you have a question. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Lee and Madison's back to polar bears for a minute, wondering, what do zoos feed polar bears?
That's a good question. I once fed a polar bear at a zoo. It was when I was starting out as a journalist, and it was a heat wave in Toronto, Canada. And I was like, should we go to the zoo? And of course, as you propose when you're an intern. And we fed it fish-sicles, which was fish, you know, popsicles to help the polar bear cool down. I don't know too much about what the zoo, I mean, I assume they just eat a lot of meat, right? If they don't have to catch it, they'll probably eat, you know, anything. I don't think they're feeding them seals, so.
And Jack in Madison wonders if scientists are proposing creating hybrid bears to expand the overall world population of bears. That kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier with the grizzlies and the polar bears.
It seems a bit like a Jurassic Park kind of approach to bears, perhaps. I don't think that they're planning on engineering new bear species, but it might happen naturally. So.
His favorite bear is he says in passing, his favorite bear is the grizzly bear. And you did, you talk about grizzly bears in the book. And it's, I think you mentioned it, or somebody said in your book, it's the biggest success of the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah.
Talk about the act and explain it in relation to the bear.
Yeah, so I mean, the Endangered Species Act came about in the 1970s to try and protect species from going extinct, essentially, right? So, I mean, we've seen some attempts to, I guess, disembowel that act under the Trump administration more recently, but there's quite a few animals that are on the ESA, and the grizzly bear was kind of one of the first and most iconic species to be listed under the ESA back then. And at the time, you know, there were very few left in the lower 48 or a couple hundred, you know, at most. And the U.S. kind of thought they might go extinct in the lower 48 locally. They've still, a lot of bears up in Alaska still. But over the past, you know, 50 years or so, they've made a pretty good comeback. And they're at nearly, I think, 2,000 bears across the lower 48 now. There's been multiple attempts to remove protections from the bears that are living around Yellowstone because people think that they've kind of reached, you know, the most bears that that area can handle. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the ESA, it's been a success story, and people, you know, with agencies, they want to use it as a poster child for, you know, what can happen through these sorts of protections.
One of the things I liked about your book is you not only talk to the experts, but you talk to local people who are affected by, and whatever country you happen to be in that were affected by it. And with grizzlies, you talk to a woman farmer. We actually had a very large grizzly on her property, a 900-pounder or something.
Yeah, his name was Black Bart. Yeah, I think it's important to speak with the people who live alongside bears. And I think she made some good points about, you know, of course, people living in cities, you know, they want to restore grizzly bears to all of these places. But if you actually are out there living with bears, you know, it's a bit scary, and it's more work to have to coexist with these animals. And she, I think, offered a really nuanced perspective. And, you know, she wasn't anti-bear, she wasn't pro-bear, but she was kind of like, this is the reality of living with, you know, these predators and these carnivores pretty close to our cows and, you know, close to my kids. And yeah, it's, I think she had a good point.
And the close proximity brings me to bears and people, brings me to sloth bears.
The world's probably the world's least known bear species, I would say.
But the biggest killer of humans.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that, of course, as I mentioned in the book, is because millions of people live pretty close to the sloth bear. We don't have millions of people living close to the polar bear. But at the same time, like, the sloth bear is actually pretty aggressive. It's used to fighting with tigers on the landscape for some reason, and scientists aren't quite sure why it's so kind of angry and quick to fight. But it, you know, if it bumps into someone and you're not paying attention, it might, you know, it's a good chance it will attack you versus some of the other bear species, you know, which might just run the other way.
Well, and you, and sloth bear, sloth is probably a misnomer, I think, as you talk about the name of the bear itself.
Yeah, nothing to do with sloths. I think it was some early European explorers who saw it and thought it looked like a sloth. To me, it does not look at all like a sloth. So I don't know why they thought that. It's very furry. It's very shaggy. It does have long hooked claws. But so they called it like a bear-like sloth initially. And then it's kept the name, even though it's, you know, not at all correct.
And you put yourself in a bit of danger, I thought.
Seeing the sloth bear?
Going out. You were out in the fields with a guy who wasn't as afraid of sloth bears as maybe should have been.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of funny. We'd spent, you know, I spent a couple months in India traveling and meeting all the people who'd been attacked by these bears, seeing these pretty gruesome injuries. And then we were in kind of these little forest cabins in Gujarat, which is in western India. And I was with one of the key sloth bear scientists, and some sloth bears arrived at our camp that night, and they were up in the tree eating some seed pods. And he was like, you know, come on outside and come see the bear family that's here. We kind of positioned ourselves behind a car door with like the headlights on the bear so that we had a shield against them. But it was a little, you know, when they started to come down the tree, that's kind of, I think, when we ran back inside.
I was thinking of another time when you were out in a field with some large boulders.
Yeah, that was another scientist who was keen to kind of climb into the boulders and into the bear dens, and there's leopards and stuff there too. I passed on that opportunity because we weren't really near a hospital, I thought. But
well,
a bit blasé.
You know, there have to be challenges at the same time that sloth bears, and where the problems exist in India are whereby happenstance or whatever, maybe not happenstance, the bears become in more close contact with people.
Yeah, and part of that is because I think India, as the scientists pointed out, they've kind of prioritized tiger conservation. So they're protecting the parks and like making sure that the resources meet the tigers' needs. But sometimes that pushes the sloth bear out because sloth bears don't want to live with tigers, or I wouldn't want to live with a tiger either. So the bears are kind of staying on the periphery of the park, but that's often closer to people. So they're getting into more conflict because there's just not enough habitat when you have so many people and other animals nearby.
Are there creative ways that they're working with sloth bears to try and...
Yeah, Gujarat's made a lot of progress. They're trying to basically make sure that there's like artificial watering holes, there's termite mounds, or they... Sloth bears mostly eat insects, not people. So they're trying to make sure that, you know, there's enough water and food to keep bears in protected areas and prevent them from wandering out into villages.
Did we talk about pandas yet? I don't think we've...
No, no pandas, no moon bears, yeah.
The sun and moon bears and the panda bears are the sun and moon bears, you refer to them, or people refer to them as bio bears. And that was probably the most heart-wrenching part of your book. I mean, there are funny parts in your book, and there's some great conversations that you have with people. But there again, you put yourself into harm's way a bit in Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to. So, I mean, just a quick recap. Bear bile is used as a kind of a traditional Chinese medicine throughout Asia, and people, you know, they drink it, they rub it on their knees and their backs. It's a long history throughout Asia, and the way that they do that is by keeping moon bears and some sun bears in these really tight little cages. And in China, it's quite a large kind of. It's almost industrialized. It's like these pharmaceutical companies that have, you know, bear bile. But in Vietnam, it's typically families who might have, you know, a few bears. I saw one operation in Vietnam that had 30 bears. And, you know, they're extracting bile from the bear's gallbladders every few weeks to, you know, it's not a big moneymaker. It's kind of just like tradition and culture. But it was definitely the hardest part of my reporting in this book.
Yeah, to see the kinds of conditions that they were in. It was kind of tough to read about, at least in that section. And pandas, let's go back to pandas for
a... On a lighter note, a fluffier note, yeah.
Yeah, pandas probably, I mean, there aren't a lot of pandas, but you say they're not going to become extinct, you don't think, ever.
I mean, I don't think, look how much money and time China's put into kind of panda conservation. And China's unique in that they have the monopoly on pandas. Like pandas don't live anywhere else. So yeah, I think, you know, they're the symbol of the World Wildlife Fund. We've seen China protect huge areas of habitat for the panda just in the past decade. They're breeding them in captivity. Most of those are being used as like diplomatic bribes as opposed to be going to the wild, but they are trying to put more bears back into the wild now too.
It's it was interesting to me. They've had a lot of breeding efforts. Oh, you tell a very funny story. Well, I don't know if it's funny. about the pandas, mostly they wanted the ones in captivity. Mostly they wanted to eat and sleep, and they didn't want to bother with sex.
Yeah, they weren't too interested in mating. And there's this scientist in China, and he, you know, he's just trying everything to get the bears to have sex. So he's, you know, there's Viagra, he's going to sex stores in Chengdu to see if he can find like sex toys. They're screening panda pornography. So they make the pandas watch videos of other pandas having sex in hopes that like maybe they'll breed. But eventually now they've just kind of gone like the IVF route basically, right? They just inseminate the pandas to try and get cubs.
Well, and I think in the wild they have sex, but there's a different process that goes on in the wild.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's all about pheromones and timing, and, you know, there's kind of scent markers and cues in the wilderness that you just don't have in captivity. So the pandas were, you know, pretty content to just sit there and eat bamboo instead of some raunchier behavior.
Well, you know, near the end of your book, you have some final thoughts on the future of bears. What's in store for bears, and how can we help them?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're kind of at this critical point, and I don't know that I mentioned already, but, you know, 6 of the world's 8 bear species are threatened with extinction currently. I think only the brown bear and the American black bear are considered pretty secure globally. So the next few decades, depending on what we do and if we can, you know, make space for some of these bears, will really dictate their future for species like the polar bear and the spectacle bear that are, you know, impacted by climate change. I think that's kind of, those are the kind of the highest risk bears, because it's, you know, we're not making a lot of progress when it comes to tackling climate change, not even to save ourselves, save the bears. But for species like, you know, the sun and moon bear on bile farms, we can make progress there. And, you know, we're seeing Vietnam has banned bile bear farming. They're trying to get all the bears onto sanctuaries. So we are seeing kind of these glimmers of hope with some species when it comes to poaching and habitat, but climate change is kind of the big one to tackle.
Your book hasn't been out that long. How's it doing?
Well, it came out yesterday, so I guess we'll see what your listeners do after this.
Oh, I didn't realize it had been back. I had the hardcover copy, so
yeah, you got the advanced copy, but no, it's just we're on day 2, so we'll see.
Well, I hope it does very well, because it's so, you're a great writer, and you tell just a fascinating story about our 8 species of bears. I want to thank you so much, Gloria, for writing the book and also for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, and to all the callers who called in to share some of their own little bear stories.
You haven't started on anything new yet, have you?
Not yet. No, I'm going to take a break for a bit, I think.
You need to do some promoting for this book.
Yeah, exactly.
Gloria, thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Gloria Dickey is the author of 8 Bears, Mythic Past and Imperiled Future. And we really only scratched the surface of her book today as we talked with her. And I just know you're going to enjoy getting your hands on a copy of the book and reading it. And you're going to be surprised, sometimes amazed. You're going to feel bad at other times, but you're going to laugh as well at some points of the book. It's a wonderful, wonderful read, and you will like it.